hope they heard that in the West Bank. Seriously. I'm glad that kind of set a lighthearted mood, too, because Revelation is a book that we've taken much too seriously, and I hope over the next few weeks you understand why I think that way. The lectionary text that you heard read from the lectern this morning is from that last book of the Bible, Revelation, and it is really difficult to know how to approach this book from the pulpit. It's certainly fair to say that Revelation is the most misunderstood book of the Bible. I recently read Marcus Borg's latest book, which is entitled Reading the Bible Again for the First Time. And in that book, I found what I believe is the best overview of the book of Revelation that I've ever discovered. So over the next couple of weeks, I'll give you an overview of Revelation, stating right up front that I am relying on the work of Marcus Borg. I'm using his writing for both the outline of my presentation and for the bulk of its content. Today, we'll review the book of Revelation. We'll consider who wrote it, how it's been viewed over the ages, and we'll examine that amazing story itself and the mind-boggling visions we find in the book. Next week, we'll look at the two very different ways the book can be approached, the two interpretations of Revelation we find in the world today. But we can't interpret all the stuff going on in Revelation if we don't read over the story first. Revelation is positioned as the last book of the New Testament, and thus at the end of the Bible. It wasn't the last book to be written, and the person who wrote it certainly had no clue that his work would one day wind up at the end of the Christian canon. Its location in the Bible is due to its subject matter, the end of the world. The Bible begins with the words, "In the beginning," and concludes with a book about how everything ends: God's judgment on the world, the second coming of Christ, Satan's destruction, and the New Jerusalem coming down from heaven. Because the Hal Lindseys and the Tim LaHayes of this world have used Revelation to scare people into the faith, which I view as the absolute lowest form of evangelism and a perversion of the Christian message, many serious Christians through the ages have wished this book had never been included in the Bible. And it almost wasn't. As the theologians of the early church debated for about 300 years what writings would be included in the official Christian Bible and what writings should be left out, the book of Revelation generated the most heated debate. It was not only positioned as the last book in the Bible, it was quite literally the last book to make it into the Bible. The Protestant reformers didn't have many nice things to say about the book of Revelation. The three major leaders of the Protestant Reformation were Martin Luther, Ulrich Zwingli, and John Calvin. Martin Luther felt it maintained a secondary stature among the books of the Bible and said he personally wished he could throw it into the Elbe River. Ulrich Zwingli refused to even accept it as a part of the Bible. He said it was a mistake that it had been included in the canon. And John Calvin wrote in-depth commentaries on every book of the New Testament with the exception of Revelation, which he simply chose to ignore. The word Revelation is a translation of the Greek word apokalypsis. The words revelation and apocalypse are synonyms. The person who wrote the book was named John, so the full title of the book is written one of two ways: the Revelation of John or the Apocalypse of John. And this is as good a time as any to note that the book is not entitled Revelations. The title is singular, Revelation, or the Revelation of John. The word apocalypse needs to be thought of in two ways. Its definition is an unveiling or a revelation. But it's also a type of literature. There was a 300-year period from about 200 BC to 100 AD when apocalyptic literature was popular. It deals with mysterious symbols, heavenly futures, numbers with secret meanings, evil powers being overthrown by God, amazing beasts described in lurid detail, intense suffering, and catastrophes of epic proportions, along with Revelation, the second half of the book of Daniel from the Old Testament is the other biblical writing that fits into this category. John, the author, lived off the coast of modern-day Turkey on the island of Patmos. The claim that this is the same John who wrote the fourth gospel is rejected by almost all modern scholars. The John who authored the book of Revelation most likely wrote it somewhere around the year 95 AD, although a minority of Bible scholars argue it was written earlier, in the 60s, during the reign of the Roman Emperor Nero. To tease you with the direction of our discussion, and hopefully to encourage you to want to return next week when we'll examine and put to rest some of the myths surrounding the book of Revelation, let me explain why some scholars think the book was written during Nero's reign. The number 666, the sign of the beast, the number of the Antichrist, has modern-day prophets of doom continually on the lookout for the hidden meaning of the number, so they'll be able to recognize the Antichrist when he rises up to take over the world. But the number 666, using the rules of an ancient coding method called gematria, is translated Caesar Nero. And most modern scholars will insist that if you want to find the person the number 666 is referring to, you needn't look to the future for some Antichrist. You should rather look to the past, 2,000 years in the past, to the Emperor of Rome. But I'm getting way ahead of the story. We must attempt to recap the whole book from start to end. As we begin that process, however, I want to emphasize that there are two very different ways to read this book. While these two ways of approaching the book of Revelation will be the subject of next week's sermon, it will be beneficial if you at least have some idea of these two very different approaches before you hear the book summarized. One approach is to view the book as one man's amazing vision of the future, a vision that is literally true and must happen because it's found in the Bible. And the other approach is to view this book as one man's symbolic examination of the world he lived in. The way one chooses to approach this story makes all the difference in the world. In fact, it reads like two completely different stories depending on which approach you take. Is this a story about the future of our world today? Or is it a story about a world 2,000 years in the past? For the time being, we'll turn to the Revelation of John and let the story speak for itself. Revelation is actually a letter. It is a letter inspired by a series of visions written by John of Patmos to the seven churches in Asia. John writes, "I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day, and I heard behind me a loud voice like a trumpet saying, 'Write in a book what you see, and send it to the seven churches, to Ephesus, to Smyrna, to Pergamum, to Thyatira, to Sardis, to Philadelphia, and to Laodicea.'" When John turns to see who is speaking to him, he sees the risen Christ. I want to read word for word the way he describes what he sees because it is typical of the heavy symbolism and rich imagery of apocalyptic literature. "Then I turned to see whose voice it was that spoke to me, and on turning I saw seven golden lampstands, and in the midst of the lampstands I saw one like the Son of Man, clothed with a long robe, with a sash across his chest. His head and his hair were white as snow. His eyes were like a flame of fire. His feet were burnished bronze, refined as in a furnace, and his voice like the sound of many waters. In his right hand he held seven stars, And from his mouth came a sharp, two-edged sword, and his face was like the sun shining with full force. After reviving John, according to the story, John faints dead away when he sees all this, as we might imagine he would. This amazing figure who represents the risen Christ concludes John's first vision by saying, "Now write what you have seen, what is and what is to take place after this. As for the mystery of the seven stars you saw in my right hand and the seven golden lampstands, the seven stars are the angels of the seven churches, and the seven lampstands are the seven churches." Visions, imagery, symbolic numbers, all the elements of apocalyptic literature are present in that first vision of John. Throughout the book, John uses the words, "I saw," to preface each vision, and he uses the words, "I saw," over 50 times. Overviewing the rest of the book, the number 7 keeps appearing. In biblical literature, 7 is the number that symbolizes perfection. Just a few examples. God created the world in 7 days. The land was to lie fallow every 7 years. Pharaoh's dream had 7 good years, followed by 7 bad years. Jacob worked 7 years to make Rachel his bride, and 7 more when he was given Leah instead of Rachel. Quality silver is described as being refined 7 times. It goes on and on. In the book of Revelation, the first vision contains 7 stars, 7 lampstands, and 7 churches. Future visions have 7 letters, 7 seals, 7 bowls, and 7 trumpets. And the book itself is constructed with 7 beatitudes, 7 hymns, 7 categories of people, 7 references to the altar, and 7 proclamations of the second coming of Christ. As you can see, Revelation is filled with symbolism. Perhaps this should warn us of the danger of reading it literally instead of symbolically. The 2nd and 3rd chapters of the book contain the individual letters to the 7 churches, written through John, but being put forth as the words of the risen Christ, the guy we met earlier in John's first amazing vision. Each letter evaluates how that particular church is doing, and then offers either threats or encouragement. Those 7 churches were facing persecution, false teachings, and a tendency to accommodate the larger culture. If they are facing these tests properly, the risen Christ, through John, gives them a nice pat on the back. If they're failing, he really lets them have it. For example, he writes to the church in Philadelphia, "I know your works, and you have kept my words and not denied my name. I will keep you from the hour of trial that is coming on the whole world to test the inhabitants of earth. I will write on you the name of my God." He's not quite so happy with some of the other churches. To the church at Laodicea, he writes, "I know your works. You are neither hot nor cold. I will spit you out of my mouth." And to the church at Sardis, he writes, "I know your works. You have a name of being alive, but you are dead. I have not found your works perfect in the sight of my God." In both of those cases, the letters offer those churches one last chance to get their acts together before the soon-to-come end of the world. Chapters 4 through 22 contain the series of visions that fill the rest of the book. This series begins with John seeing an open door and peeking through to another layer of reality. Nobody has ever summarized this 19 chapters of material as well as Marcus Borg, and I'm not going to try to improve on it. This is Borg's overview of what John sees when he peeks through that door. The section begins with a vision of God enthroned in heaven, surrounded by 24 elders clothed in white crowns with gold on their heads. 4 beasts are around the throne, each with 6 wings and eyes in the middle of their wings, strange creatures from another world. From the throne itself come lightning and thunder and voices. It continues with a vision of the Lamb that was slain, but that now lives and is worthy to open the seven seals of the scroll of judgment. As the seven seals are opened, we see the four horsemen of the apocalypse riding forth upon the earth, bringing war, famine, pestilence, and death. Then there is a great earthquake. The sky blackens, the stars fall from the heavens, and the sky rolls up like a scroll. The seventh seal is finally opened, and it introduces another series of seven judgments. Seven angels begin to blow seven trumpets in succession. The blowing of the trumpets unleashes another series of plagues and catastrophes on the earth, including giant locusts that look like horses equipped for battle, bearing tails like scorpions and making noise like many chariots. Wait till you see what Hal Lindsey does with that. And an immense army of 200 million invading from the east. At the start of chapter 12, things start getting interesting. We see a vision of a woman clothed like the sun, a crown of 12 stars on her head, and the moon under her feet. She is giving birth to a child whom a great red dragon immediately tries to devour. At the same time, war breaks out throughout heaven. The archangel Michael and his angels battle against the great dragon, who loses and is cast down to earth. In chapter 13, a beast with seven heads and 10 horns, whom the dragon has given authority, rises out of the sea and takes control of the earth. The number of the beast, we are told, is 666. The seven angels pour out upon the earth the seven bowls of the wrath of God, and we are shown the judgment and destruction of the great harlot who rides upon the beast and whose name is Babylon the Great. This is soon followed at last by the second coming of Christ, who arrives on a white horse. Christ leads the army clad in white robes against the armies of the beast and destroys them, their bodies becoming food for carrion birds that gorge themselves with their flesh. The dragon, which has now been given the name the devil, is cast into a bottomless pit for 1,000 years, during which Christ and the saints rule. After 1,000 years, Satan is released, and with Gog and Magog, he fights a final battle, and the devil is again defeated. Then the last judgment occurs. All the dead, great and small, are raised. The book of life is opened, and all whose names are not in it are cast into the lake of fire, along with the devil, the beast, death, and Hades. After all of this, at the beginning of chapter 21 comes the magnificent concluding vision. The new Jerusalem, adorned as a bride for her new husband, descends from the sky, a city in which there will be no more tears, no pain, no death. The city has no need of a temple, for its temple is the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb. Nor does the city have need of a sun or moon, for the glory of God will be its light, and its lamp, the Lamb of God. Through it flows the river of the water of life, and in it grows the tree of life, whose leaves are for the healing of the nations. There, the seven servants of God will worship God and the Lamb. I quote Revelation, they will see God's face, and God's name will be on their foreheads, and there will be no more night. They need no light of lamp or sun, for the Lord God will be their light, and they will reign forever and ever. John then concludes the book of Revelation with a short epilogue and a benediction. That's some story. It's easy to understand why some people have wondered if there were some psychedelic mushrooms growing on the island of Patmos. Frankly, considering that an outrageously large number of people believe that all the things we heard this morning are soon to happen just exactly as I said them, I have to wonder if the spores from those psilocybin mushrooms aren't floating around in the air we breathe. The question, of course, is whether we believe all the things John wrote about in Revelation are destined to happen at some time in the future, or whether a scholarly examination of the story can provide us with another explanation of all those mysterious symbols and amazing images we find on the pages of that book. Next week, we will examine the two ways of approaching this book. We'll first consider the futurist interpretation of Revelation, and that is the popular way of approaching the book. It's all true. It's got to be. It's in the Bible. We'll look at the ways people have taken a fundamentalist view of the inerrancy of the Bible and managed to scare people witless over the book of Revelation. We'll look at how a man named Schofield reinterpreted the Bible and set the stage for 20th century fundamentalism, claiming that our primary purpose in life is to decipher the clues we find in the Bible so as to escape the wrath of the angry God we find in the Bible. We'll examine a book called The Late Great Planet Earth, in which author Hal Lindsey explains many of the amazing visions in Revelation as things we see all around us today, indicating the end of the world is surely near. And then we'll look at the other way of reading this book. We'll discover that all those images, all those amazing visions, are meant to symbolize people and things found in the ancient world, the world in which John wrote the story. And perhaps we'll start to take seriously the words of Raymond Brown, widely regarded as the greatest New Testament scholar of the 20th century. I leave you with his words I included in the latest church newsletter, which I believe deserve to be repeated. God has not revealed to human beings details about how the world began or how the world will end. And failing to recognize that, one is likely to misread both the first book and the last book of the Bible. The author of Revelation did not know how or when the world will end, and neither does anybody else. See you next week.